Hello, Park Street. Welcome back. Today is day 38 of Lent. I'm happy to be recording today with the one, the only, Pastor Nate.
Hi, Holy Reverend.
Hi, Holy Reverend, from episode 0 and 1. Thanks for doing this, Nate. I appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Today's passage is John 19, verses 1 through 16. Go ahead and read it.
Then Pilate took Jesus and had him flogged. The soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head. They clothed him in purple and went up to him again and again, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they slapped him in the face. Once more, Pilate came out and said to the Jews gathered there, "Look, I'm bringing him out to you to let you know that I find no basis for a charge against him." When Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe, Pilate said to them, "Here is the man." As soon as the chief priests and their officials saw him, they shouted, "Crucify, crucify." But Pilate said, "You take him and crucify him. As for me, I find no basis for a charge against him." The Jewish leaders insisted, "We have a law, and according to that law, he must die because he claimed to be the Son of God." When Pilate heard this, he was even more afraid and went back inside the palace. "Where do you come from?" he asked Jesus. But Jesus would give him no answer. "Do you refuse to speak to me?" Pilate said. "Don't you realize I have power either to free you or to crucify you?" Jesus answered, "You would have no power over me if it were not given to you from above. Therefore, the one who's handed me over to you is guilty of a greater sin." From then on, Pilate tried to set Jesus free, but the Jewish leaders kept shouting, "If you let this man go, you are no friend of Caesar. Anyone who claims to be a king opposes Caesar." When Pilate heard this, he brought Jesus out and sat down on the judge's seat at a place known as the Stone Pavement, which in Aramaic is Gabbatha. It was a day of preparation on the Passover, and it was about noon. "Here is your king," Pilate said to the Jews. But they said, take him away, crucify him." "Shall I crucify your king?" Pilate asked. "We have no king but Caesar," the chief priests answered. Finally, Pilate handed him over to be crucified.
All right. Thanks, Nate. There's a lot going on inside this 16 verses.
Right.
Do you know why Pilate flogged Jesus and then says, "I have no basis for any charge"? Is that just kind of standard, like, opening... You know, like, it doesn't matter if you're guilty or not, you just kind of get a flogging right off the bat. Like, or how does that work? You know, it doesn't seem like...
everyone could use a good flogging.
Right, like, what's going on?
So, normally, you either received flogging or capital punishment, which in Rome at the time was crucifixion. It was almost always the case as one or the other. And a lot of biblical scholars argue that they actually can't prove of any other case recorded of someone receiving both. So I think for Pilate, and we see his reasoning as he's continuing to interact with Jesus, I think Pilate sees this guy as a potential rabble-rouser, but not someone who is deserving of capital punishment. And so Pilate go ahead and has him flogged, kind of thinking, this is it. Like, we flogged him, he's learned a lesson here, surely... They're not going to also demand crucifixion after he's received this very severe... I mean, flogging, it's not a cakewalk.
Right, right. It's like, wasn't there the thing about like 39 lashes or something like that? Like, yeah. It was like they're bringing him up to close to dying, but just not enough to get him quite there.
It is brutal. It is a brutal public, you know, kind of punishment. And so I think, you know, in Pilate's reasoning is kind of like, I'm going to do the flogging to kind of sate... the masses here, and then, you know, we'll just let this guy go, and he'll probably not be a lot of trouble for us anymore, you know, having experienced the hardship and the pain of flogging and stuff. It seems that Pilate doesn't want to see Jesus killed, and so this is kind of what he's trying to do here.
Do you think it says in verse 8 that he was frightened, more frightened than ever, when he learned that Jesus called himself the Son of God? Do you think Pilate is considering the fact that Jesus' claims about himself are true? Or do you think he's just, he's kind of a good guy, not a, you know, he's not a good guy, but he's like, I don't want to just crucify a dude just cause, right? Like, he has to, I'm not allowed to just go to that extreme, and so he's kind of like, unless I really have a reason. Or do you think he really is considering the fact that, like, Jesus is who he said he was?
I think that Pilate definitely is intrigued by Jesus. It's not common for him to interview people who are receiving the punishment of the state. I mean, he's
right.
He's the governor of the area. I mean, he's not wasting right. his time talking to people who are guilty of minor or even more major crimes. The scripture says that his wife has a dream.
Yeah.
About Jesus. And she kind of talks to him about it, so that there's already some kind of maybe supernatural work that is keying Pilate into this guy might be more than who he says he is. And in the Synoptic Gospels, he gets into this whole conversation with Jesus about what is truth. And even though he seems to obviously not be a convert, he doesn't right. affirm the deity of Christ. He's certainly unnerved by Jesus and not sure what to make of him.
Yeah. I like what you said about the fact that he's kind of intrigued, but he's unnerved, but he also is self-interested in the fact that he has to deal with it eventually, and he's trying not to deal with it, but then he has to deal with it. You know, he's kind of stuck, yeah. it seems.
Well, yeah, and to your point of, like, is Pilate a good guy? I think no.
Yeah, because if he was to be governor of Rome by being a good guy.
Well, right. Well, and in this instance, too, is like, he believes Jesus isn't deserving of this crime, but allows him to be crucified. I mean, like, there's a... right there is the lack of integrity, you know, the lack of saying, you know what, I'm not, like, indebted to the Sanhedrin in any way. They yeah. can be mad at me all they want. You don't just get to kill people because you want to. but that's not the route he goes. And I think the most haunting lines of this whole passage are those last lines that the Jewish leaders say of, you know, anyone who claims to be a king opposes Caesar, so you're not a friend of Caesar. You know, they're threatening him with, like, you know, what's going to happen to you? Like, are you,
right.
And then that last line of, we have no king but Caesar. I think that's a pretty haunting statement to make, especially in partisan America in 2019. You know, we have no king but Caesar is like, rut-row.
Right. Like, their ultimate allegiance, they're like, you yeah. know, they've made their decision yeah. on who they're going to support. I find that interesting, too. I'm glad you brought that up. So in 1 Samuel chapter 8, there's, it records Israel's first request for a king. So when Samuel got old, his sons were evil. Yeah. They said, you know, and the elders of Israel come to Samuel and they say, look, you're old, your sons are evil, give us a king. And it says Samuel was displeased with their request. This is 1 Samuel 8, 6, 6 through 9. And it says, Samuel was displeased with their request and went to the Lord for guidance. It says, do everything they say to you, the Lord replied, for they're rejecting me, not you. They don't want me to be their king any longer. Ever since I brought them from Egypt, they have continually abandoned me and followed other gods. And now they are giving you the same treatment. Do as they ask, but solemnly warn them about the way a king will reign over them. You know, and it's like
yeah.
the New Testament version of this, you know, Jesus is coming as king.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just like completely and utterly rejecting his kingdom. I just thought about that passage when like you said, those words, like, we have no king but Caesar, right? Like, it's like, and Caesar was not nice to them. Yeah. I mean, it's not like they had it good. We talk about, like, the themes in the Old Testament of, like, you know, the Israelites in the desert saying, you know, I wish we could just go back to Egypt and live right. under the Pharaoh. It's right. like they got so deluded right. and so disenchanted and disenfranchised with God that they considered slavery under probably the worst tyrant of the known world
right.
preferable to right. being God's people, right. right? And it's like, it just seems like these are the, it says, the leading priests, right? Like, yeah. These are the guys.
Chief priests.
Right. These are the guys in charge. Just yeah. like the elders in the First Samuel, like the guys in charge, the leadership right. of this nation is saying, you know, we've rejected God again.
Well, there's a couple layers to this, and they're all equally damning, right? The first is they want to go out of their way to tell Caesar, we have nothing to do with this kind of insurgence that this guy kind of represents for us, right? That's their key concern with Jesus, is that he is attempting to establish a political coup against Rome, which would result in the decimation of all Jews, right? And so that's their line of thinking, better for one man to die
yeah.
than the whole nation. So this line is them distancing themselves, like, look, we're not like this guy. He wants to, you know, raise and organize the zealots. We have no king but Caesar. There's also this kind of, absolutely, this kind of, what would you say, sycophantic kind of like appeal. Like they feel like, it feels like a kid whining, you know, like, you know, I'm the most loyal, you know, what can I please, you know, have this pony, or, you know, can you please just crucify this guy? So that's another, but yeah, the third part of it is absolutely the spiritual significance of these people saying, even though their entire scripture identifies Yahweh as king, for them to say we have no king but Caesar is, I just think, so full of a revelation of where their heart is. Exactly what you're saying.
Yeah. And like in yesterday's recording, we talked about the, you know, the demand to have Barabbas released instead yeah. of Jesus. And right. it's like, there's no ambiguity, right? Of the dividing line is pretty clear, you know, yeah. it's black and white. And yeah. it's like, they've totally rejected Jesus in favor of Barabbas and in favor of Caesar. And just the contrast of that is pretty stark. I know at one point, this was probably a couple months ago, maybe more, you did a sermon on thorns. It says right. in verse 5, it says Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, I remember pieces and parts of the sermon about, you know, just like the idea of thorns is kind of a recurring theme throughout the Bible. It starts when, you know, Adam and Eve sin, they're cast out of the garden, and it says, you know, like, they're, instead of like this idea that the world's producing this prosperity and, you know, kind of like lush habitat, they have, you know, desolation and thorns and right. dryness, you know, like. And do you have any thoughts, I guess, on the crown of thorns and the purple robe?
I mean, yeah, the thorns specifically in the New Testament are connected to sin in the Old and New Testament. So, right, exactly what you're saying. Like Genesis 3, because of Adam and Eve's sin, now the earth will produce, you know, thorns and weeds and thistles. Throughout the prophetic literature, thorns are always a sign of sin, you know. And so for them to put a crown on his head, I mean, this is the beauty of this is like they are just mocking Jesus right. in a painful way.
Right.
So like, what do kings wear? Robes and crowns. So we're gonna mock this guy. We're gonna put a robe on him. We're gonna put a crown on his head, but it's gonna be a painful crown. It's not gonna be, you know. So this is just more of their humiliation. You know, they put a blindfold over his head and they're punching him and they're saying, "Prophesy who hit you." So this right. is just a part of their mocking of Jesus. But the fact that they chose thorns that represent the consequence of sin, and they put it on Jesus's head. I mean, this is the salvation plan of God becoming visible. Yeah. He puts on the consequences of sin, is crucified, even though he is the king. He is wearing purple. Purple is the royal color. So that we do not have to wear the consequences of sin in our lives. It's so beautiful, and I love it that it is God even using their evil, their rebellion, and their disrespect, their mocking of Jesus
yeah.
to communicate his salvation plan for the world.
Well, and it kind of, it shows you, I guess, another theme of kind of God's, I guess, sovereignty or control or whatever you want to call it, right? Like, these people have all these plans that they're executing, and they're doing it from a complete place, like you said, of just ulterior motives and, you know, rejection and inflicting pain and all that, and and yet God is, you know, and John is pointing this stuff out very, like, he's putting this stuff in here to kind of show you, like, the hints of what he's trying to say, that, like, God was using this, these kind of evil, violent, destructive people to bring about the very thing he was planning on doing, which is cool, because you don't always get to see, you know, you typically think of the, I mean, there's a lot of evil in the world now, right? And you still, like, is there hope for evil to be used for redemptive purposes or not, right? Like, it can be, and God is still able to use those things. He has a separate, he has a separate motivation, right, that that people don't have.
Yeah, Isaiah 55 is, you know, that my life chapter of scripture, and the last verses of, or the last verse of Isaiah 55, verse 15 says, instead of a thorn bush, the juniper will grow, and instead of briars, the myrtle will grow, and this will be an everlasting sign of the Lord's renown, which will endure forever. And the idea is, instead of these thorns, the consequence of sin and rebellion, evergreens are going to be there, you know. And so instead of sinfulness, there's going to be a green flourishing that never goes out of season. And so I just love that image of that. Obviously, yeah, John is highlighting here in Jesus's own crucifixion and death.
Yeah. And I mean, it's bad. I mean, that's the thing too, is just, as like it mentions, the flogging, the crown of thorns, they hit him. You know, like, it's just kind of really difficult. You know, we've read this, read these passages enough, or I have, for my life, that it's just, it's really hard to actually consider what that was really like, you know, like the amount of pain and humiliation. I mean, I know, like, obviously Jesus handled it, you know, and he knew he was going to handle it, but the idea of, you know, him going through an experience that was that, I guess, I don't know the word I'm looking for, that was that just kind of loaded with emotional and physical pain, like, it was like, it was, there's multiple, it's multi-layer in terms of, like, the pain that he went through, right? Like, it's physical, but it's also emotional. I mean, it's like, you kind of think, like, well, he's Jesus, you know, he had the ability to, you know, deal with it better than we could. I mean, he's God, and he's also a human being, and, you know, the utter humiliation and pain of this whole thing is just very jarring to me, as you actually start to go back and think about, like, John makes the, you know, the comment that's a lead-tipped whip, right? Like, I mean, just, like, it's just has to be excruciating pain, you know?
Yeah, the fact that Jesus is only on the cross for 6 hours before he dies, I think, is a indicator of how much he's actually been through up to this point. You know, if the other folks who were crucified on either side of him probably lasted a lot longer than he did, but
they didn't get the flogging, because they said earlier, it was either one or the other. So Jesus was already brought within, you know, a couple inches of life and death before he was crucified.
Right. So these these crucifixions could sometimes be multiple day affairs. Right. Sometimes they lasted 2 and 3 days before people finally asphyxiated, is how you die in crucifixion. And yeah, Jesus dies in 6 hours, which is still, I mean, it's not like he got off easy or anything. We're just
It's loading up the 2 days or 3 days of pain and boiling it down into even more intensity.
Concentrated, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, so Mel Gibson's The Passion, I think, has probably done the best job of making this, how brutal this was, to making you see it. I remember just kind of being almost, you know, like, this is over the top, you know, like, everybody had that critique when that movie first came out, is that it was too gory. But Gibson, you know, for whatever your thoughts are as a human actor or director, was attempting to be as true to the text as he could be. And so this is really the degree in which Jesus was mangled to a pulp before he even made it to the cross. And so, yeah, I think it's a great point. I mean, So as a dad, you know, we've got little ones in the house. And because, you know, kids are kids and they're trying to figure out life and they're testing boundaries, you get sometimes get where it's just like sheer defiance, you know? And your response to that as a parent is like, are you kidding me? Like, how dare you, you know, little tiny human who I have cared for and given everything in the world, you know, kind of take that attitude or tone with me? And this is this times infinity. I mean, he is so far above. He, you know, I love the passages in Colossians talk about how he holds the universe together. I mean, he is, without Christ, there is no anything. You know, he is the creator and sustainer of all things. And he's being so debased and so humiliated. And yeah, I think we can get kind of inoculated and to the degree in which he was humiliated and humbled and disrespected. But yeah, I think that a fresh reading of any of the synoptics, but certainly John's, helps remind you of the lengths he was willing to go to demonstrate his love for the world.
Yeah, and I struggle with that, because on the one hand, we've kind of romanticized these stories to the point where it's like we gloss over right at the top of the pain and the humiliation that Jesus suffered. And at the same time, it's like, what good does it do you to really understand all the nitty gritty of all of what he suffered, right? You know, right. It's like, it almost seems like masochistic to this, this sense of like, I don't want to enjoy the fact that like he did. Like, it's just like, I don't really know. It just kind of, my point is that emotionally when I read this, I just feel like I'm forced into this awkward, like, place where it's like I can't romanticize and skip over all the awful parts of it,
right?
But I also don't see the value, or I don't see as much of like, yeah, and then look how awful, like, it's like, it is awful. It's like, you just kind of have to like read it, sit there, watch it. It's like, but it's like you don't want to watch it,
right?
You want, it's just revolting. It's, yeah, like, I don't want to look at this. I don't want to contemplate it. It's terrible, you know?
Yeah, I definitely relate to the disciples who didn't want to be around for this. You know, it's bad enough that this is happening. I don't want to have to, like, be in the front row and observe it. Yeah, I talk about sometimes, I've heard this sermon so many times, and I've never given it once, I hope I never do, of the unnecessarily detailed and gruesome depiction of Jesus's crucifixion. And this normally happens at camp, right?
Right.
It's, and I sincerely believe it's a form of emotional manipulation, and I recognize that people have good intentions, but, you know, I've been to summer camp and I've heard this, like, very gory depiction.
And it's your fault.
That elicits an emotional response from a teenager. Okay, yeah. Congratulations, you made everybody cry. And it's not untrue because, those things happen.
It was that bad.
But, you know, I don't think we should, even though the torture and crucifixion of Christ was a catastrophic evil, we should not fixate only on the physical pain, but the spiritual sin and rebellion that resulted in the need for his sacrifice. I think that's the reason I have qualms with those sometimes, is that I feel like we lose the forest for the trees here a little bit when we so dial in on the physical torture. We shouldn't skip over it. It should make us uncomfortable. We shouldn't look away. But all of that is a demonstration of God's love for a world that is sinful and needing of his saving grace. And so keeping that at the center, I think, is a really important part.
Yeah. It's just, I'm with you. It just, it's weird. It's like, there's no easy way to just, you know, so much of studying scripture sometimes, like, we like to control to make the message palatable for us and understandable for us.
Sure.
And when it gets to a point where it becomes outside of that framework, where, you know, it's just, it leaves you with this, in this place of just unease and in this middle spot, you know, which is, I guess, part of the point. One other interesting thing, I guess, I wanted to bring up was the verse 13. It says Pilate sat down on the judgment seat on the platform,
right,
called the stone pavement. And then Pilate said to the people, "Look, here is your king." And then there's the exchange of away with him, crucify him. And then Pilate says, what? Crucify your king? Where, like, Pilate is, like, placing kind of the final judgment, right, on Jesus.
Yeah.
And, you know, throughout the book, you know, I guess when Jesus is talking to Nicodemus, he says what, like, John 3:16 says, right? For God so loved the world that he did not... For God so loved the world that he gave his only son, that whoever believes in him would not perish, but would have everlasting life. And then John 3:17 is, for, you know, God did not come into the world to condemn the world, but to save the world. And you have, like, the opposite of he's being condemned. He's a condemned man.
Yeah, you know, the account of the crucifixion and much of human history, frankly, shows that what humans consider to be the ultimate form of power is taking life. That's power, you know, from a human perspective. We want something, and if you stand in our way, the ultimate thing I can do is I can end life. So we go to war, or we get in a gang, you know, feud. I'm thinking less of inner city and more of the, you know, like the Hatfields and the McCoys, because that's more my upbringing. You know, you get in a fist fight that turns into a more than that, that turns into, and so, you know, this is very fitting that the epitome of, I mean, the Pax Romana, the peace of Rome, is crucifixion. This is how they keep the peace.
Yeah.
We come in with a very heavy hand, and we humiliate, torture, and crucify people to keep the peace. So, and again, remember that the thought of the Jewish leaders is this is going to keep us safe.
Yeah.
Him dying will keep us safe. And so this huge tension of what human strength is taking life. What, I mean, think of World War II and Hiroshima and Nagasaki, yeah. You know, like, we are the dominant power in the world. How do we know that? Because we can take the most lives the most efficiently. And what the cross exposes is that even though the epitome of power for human beings is the ability to take life, the actual power of God is the ability to bring life out of death. And so, right, Pilate sits in the judgment seat. He has the power, so he believes, because he has the power to send people to death. But actually, Jesus is the one with the power, because he's the only one who can bring life out of death.
No, it's very interesting. Thanks. I appreciate your willingness to kind of talk about this passage and kind of dialogue about it with me. We got tomorrow is Good Friday, and we've got another episode tomorrow. So even though it's not the most happy readings through these parts of the Book of Lent, I appreciate anybody who's listening. And thank you for listening, and we'll be back again tomorrow.
Thanks, Take care.